Originally, I was going to start with something that probably most of you have seen on Spectrum, and that is the reading of a scripture in which women start the reading, women pastors of the La Sierra University Church start the reading, and then one by one, male pastors from the La Sierra University come up, take their Bibles, and read in their place. And the women stand like this. I was going to have that because I thought it would be very appropriate, but we had technological difficulties. So if you want to check that out, just go to Spectrum and click on Chris Oberg's sermon. It's actually in an article by Jared Wright.
Jared Wright.
So look for Jared's article, and the sermon is embedded in that, and then you can check out the sermon, and you'll see what I was going to show you this morning. Well, this is going to be a short presentation with a lot of discussion. That's what I'm hoping from you, and I know this class likes discussion, so we will proceed quickly through these slides. Just a few preliminary remarks about Proverbs. Proverbs is one of the few books in the entire ancient Near East that really qualifies as wisdom literature. And what do I mean by that? Well, scholars debate, you know, what do we group as wisdom literature? And there's all kinds of ancient Near Eastern works that fall under that rubric. I'll be listing some of them later. But some of those pieces of literature really don't qualify as wisdom. They loosely fit in a similar genre to wisdom, but they don't really qualify as wisdom because they don't talk about wisdom. And some of their wisdom is just kind of like crafty little sayings that like we make. I don't know that we would call them wisdom sayings, but they somehow are connected to wisdom. So Proverbs is solidly wisdom literature because it deals head-on with wisdom all the way through the book. And yes, Arne.
What is a modern day
example of
we qualify in that category?
It's Poor Richard's Almanac. I know that's not modern day, but it's the closest thing. I mean, it's much more modern than ancient Near Eastern stuff. So Poor Richard's Almanac, early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Yeah. Something like that. We have a lot of sayings today that would qualify as wisdom. And in my Psalms and Wisdom literature class, I have students, we have a little contest in the room to see which group can come up with the most modern-day proverbs. And they have a lot of fun doing that. Yes, exactly. That's the favorite one, actually. And so we see who wins. And last time it was a draw. I mean, everybody just kept going and going, and the time ran out. Yes.
To kind of go with that, I was in linguistics this quarter, and there's another student in my class wrote a paper about like very contemporary modern day proverbs, I guess, versus kind of like older generation. And so one that she looked at comparing the two was like carpe diem versus YOLO, things like that. So like seize the day, and YOLO is the same thing. We use it for the same thing. Excuses, I guess, or as the same excuse, but at the same time, just comparing how the older generation looks at younger generations.
We don't think it's quite as wise as.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well,
the thing when you're teaching high school to explain to the kids what carpe
diem is. Yeah. So she was just saying, like, again, this class says it's not wisdom, but to us, it's like, okay, well, I want to, you know, go adventure, and I want to go do something with my life, and this is my excuse to do it by saying YOLO.
Yeah.
Where the older generation would say, seize the day, carpe diem is the excuse to go do those things. So she was comparing the two, like, perceptions of those things.
Well, the actual technical term for a proverb today is aphorism. And aphorism's an easier word to remember is truism. Where a wise saying is something that's inherently true, and you can't break it down and say, well, you know, it's only true in certain circumstances and so on. No, an aphorism or a truism is true in all circumstances. It's just true to life. But the basic building block of wisdom in Proverbs is mashal, and that's the term for proverb. And it is an interesting word that basically means wisdom saying or proverb, but seems to have to do with comparing one thing with another. Now, I'm going to break the rules of exegesis here, Ross. I base that actually on the root meaning of the word, which is half. There's actually a word built on mishal, meaning mishlu, in Akkadian, which means one half. And it seems to be that you have one thing over against another. And I find that works very well for Proverbs. For example, I give you two examples here, or three. Wealth brings many new friends, but a poor man is deserted by his friend. One thing is positive, the other thing is negative. Comparing and contrasting. Or a contrasting statement, a false witness will not go unpunished, and a liar will not escape, which is a synonymous parallelism. So these are examples of proverbs that really fit the traditional meaning, I think, of what is going on in proverb. There are a number of so-called wisdom works from Mesopotamia, as I mentioned, a few from Egypt, and I list them here. Shurupak, Counsels of Wisdom, Fables of a Fox, The Old Man and the Young Girl, Ludlal Bel Nemeki, which is a work that compares with Job, The Babylonian Theodicy, The Dialogue of Pessimism. If we ever do Ecclesiastes in this class, I will probably bring the Dialogue of Pessimism to you to compare with Ecclesiastes, because it makes a wonderful compare and contrast. And then Babylonian Proverbs, and then Egyptian, Instructions of Amenemhat, I never can say Egyptian words, the Maxims of Ptahhotep. And so all of these have been classified as wisdom. What are the wisdom works in the Bible? Does anybody know?
Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes.
Not Psalms. Psalms is liturgy. Worship.
Job.
Okay, so you have Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. Not a very large number of works in the Old Testament qualify. Yet scholars debate whether the term wisdom adequately describes the genre of these works, and the same scholars admit that the term wisdom does indeed apply to Proverbs. So they really, Proverbs is the wisdom book par excellence in the ancient Near East. So let's look at biblical wisdom and ancient Near Eastern wisdom. Well, most wisdom works in the ancient Near East are rooted in life experience. The Hebrew Bible emphasizes the everyday aspects of that experience more fully than do other ancient Near Eastern works. Proverbs is rooted in what I see happening around me. Job actually is a debate between real life observation of what has happening around me versus esoteric theory tradition that we have always believed and held and tried to support and defend to the death. The depth of insight seems greater in Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job than it does in comparative works, and you'll see some examples of that in a minute. The moral level of Proverbs exceeds that of, say, the instructions of Shurupak. Shurupak is an ancient king, Sumerian king, who writes words of wisdom to his son, much like the king figure in Proverbs writes wisdom to his son. So they have a lot in common in that regard. So here's an example of the moral level or lack of it. Don't buy an ass that brays, it will split your yoke. Don't place a well in your own field, the people will turn hostile against you. Terribly self-serving, right? Proverbs has little to say about how to approach God except to admonish its audience to listen to God's instruction. But the instructions of Shurupak say this: every day worship your God. Sacrifice and benediction are the proper accompaniment of incense. Present your free will offering to your God, for this is proper toward the gods. Prayer, supplication, and prostration, offer him daily, and you will get your reward. So again, very self-serving. The relationship with the God is very much based on ritual, pleasing the gods, appeasing the gods. It has nothing to do with a relationship with the gods of trust. Yeah.
How do these writings compare to the book or the writings in the Apocrypha that refer to?
Yeah, like the Wisdom of Solomon or Sirach?
Or Ecclesiastes.
Ecclesiasticus, yeah. By the time you get to those, you're dealing with really Hellenistic influence. So it's sort of like comparing apples and oranges a little, because you're in a different time period and a different way of looking at things. There's a lot of overlap between Proverbs and Ecclesiasticus, or Proverbs and Wisdom of Solomon. You know, and it's been a while since I've read those works, so I'm grappling with poor memory here. But my recollection is that they're somewhere in between, say, the counsels of Shuruppak and Proverbs in terms of moral level. But then you can find some Proverbs in Proverbs that aren't so morally high-standing either. We'll come to some of those. When I started this research in the process of writing a commentary for Spectrum, I expected to see inevitable in the terms of ancient Near Eastern perceptions that Proverbs would reflect a man's world. And of course, that's very easy to see just at a glance. Proverbs is written by a father to a son. Well, the first few chapters are by a father to his son, giving him wisdom or advice. And then, of course, it is also true of the fact that there's the adulterous woman in chapter 7 who really has bad rap and sort of casts a long shadow over all womankind, as though we are inherently adulteresses or whores or what have you. And doesn't Proverbs cast, and I'm jumping a little ahead for next week, I think next week, Vicki, aren't we doing The Virtuous Woman?
I don't know what Nancy's doing.
Okay.
she said something about talking about riddles.
Okay, well, that works too. Mishal Kamin. Actually, kida is the Hebrew word for riddle, but that's okay. It works for Proverbs too. Anyway, the virtuous woman seems to be cast in a highly impossible role, right? She does all these amazing things. It's like she never sleeps. She never does. She just does, and is just accomplishes amazing feats, and none of us can measure up.
Eugene, what I love about that, though, is give her so many accolades, but they don't talk at all about her appearance. It's a classic element of, like, where substance trumps style. You know, and so I've shared that with my girls before, you know, in work door worship or whatever. You know, and I think it's important for people to remember, I mean, for all of us, whether you're male or female, you know, if you're a person of substance, that's going to last way longer than, you know, the Toys R Us Barbie doll looks, you know.
Of course, I don't think ancient women were into Barbie doll looks. That's a rather modern...
Yeah.
Ancient women were more about covering up their appearance. But anyway, what I would like to propose is a new look at Proverbs that suggests something different is going on in the text. And this was a surprise to me. This was not something I was looking for. But it goes beyond what I presented in Spectrum to something that I hope you will find helpful. Not instructions from a father to a son, but a female figure forms the frame of the book of Proverbs. It's not the opening lines that form the frame. It's what we read for scripture reading, which is in chapter 1, provides the frame with the virtuous woman of chapter 31 for the entire book. So you have a woman frame for the book of Proverbs. The central host of wisdom is woman wisdom, built on the fact that the Hebrew word chokmah is a feminine noun. And you might think, well, that just happens to be the feminine noun, so of course it's going to be feminine and all of that. But actually, the book of Proverbs highlights wisdom as a woman. And you come to that in, I believe it's chapter 8 or 9, when she holds a feast. She prepares a banquet. She calls all society to come to her banquet and to feast on wisdom. That's a woman figure. So it's not just a feminine noun. Woman folly is also portrayed in Proverbs, but she takes up a meager 6 verses, 9:13 to 18, against woman wisdom's 70 verses. And those verses, some of the verses encompass more than several strophes, what we call strophes, which are the usual parallel element that makes up Hebrew literature. So 70 verses, it actually may be big, more strophes than just 70. While woman wisdom is referred to consistently as wisdom, woman folly is woman of folly, suggesting a characteristic of folly in a woman. So woman folly doesn't begin to have the dominance and the stature at all that woman wisdom has. While woman folly is usually depicted as an adulterous or wayward wife, woman wisdom leaves out in the open areas of the town, calling the people to forsake folly and embrace wisdom. And the instructions from the father to the son include the son's mother. Hear, my son, your father's teaching, and forsake not your mother's teaching. I use the ESV there. I hardly ever use that version. But I use it there because it translates it literally from the Hebrew, my son, whereas your inclusive language versions translate it, my child. Interesting. Which son can mean child, if you're referring to both genders. Studying Proverbs more closely, and this now goes beyond my research for Spectrum, I noticed that most of the terms of the individuals who did foolish or wise things did not involve the word man. Rather, they involved substantivized adjectives such as the humble, the proud, and the wicked, the upright, or the hypocrite, and the righteous. Of course, these adjectives are masculine. But since Hebrew does not contain common gender nouns or adjectives, the rule of thumb stands. Masculine singular and masculine plural nouns and adjectives apply to both genders. So what I discovered in my research is that Proverbs comes the closest you can find in Hebrew literature for a transgender, or I don't want to use that term, maybe in, I don't mean it in the way that I'm talking about, but beyond gender, it is all-inclusive of both male and female. Further, there are probably just as many negative proverbs directed at men as there are directed at women. In fact, going back to Proverbs 7, which is kind of the thorny one, the adulterous wife who snags and snares the man, the young man, he's looked upon very negatively in that passage. We tend to go, ooh, the woman. But actually, the man is looked at very, you know, what a sucker you are. What a fool. Why did you do that? So we need to keep that in mind. And what I did is I took the New King James Version of the Bible to read Proverbs through. And I highlighted, I have an app for you Bible, which is very nice because you can go into a whole bunch of different versions and you can color code. And so I color-coded all the positive ones for women and all the negative ones. I color-coded them in different colors. And I noticed that every time you had a negative set for women, you had a negative set for men. And every time you had a positive set for women, you had a positive set for men. It was just back and forth throughout Proverbs. And I it just really struck me in doing that, that this is a gender-inclusive book. This is a book for both genders. Something I just did not expect to find. In contrast to that, the instructions of Shurupak contain these proverbs that involve women. A man installs a good woman as a fertile field. You like that? A woman who has a fortune ruins a house. That's very much antithetical to the virtuous woman, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Don't choose a wife during a festival. Inside it is all borrowed. Outside it is all borrowed. The silver is borrowed. The lapis lazuli is borrowed. The dress is borrowed. The linen is borrowed. A she-donkey recites words in the street. And this is intended positively. Don't ask me what the positive note is. A sow suckles her young in the streets. This is referring to women. A woman who prickles herself will be screaming. She holds a spindle on which she was hurt in her hand. She enters all the houses. She peers into all the streets and keeps saying from the roofs, "Get out!" She keeps watching from all the parapets. Of course, we can find disparaging comments about women in Proverbs, such as the one cited multiple times, better to live on the edge of the roof than with a contentious woman in a large house. That is actually cited, I think, 4 or 5 times in Proverbs, some version of it. And then, of course, we have the adulterous wife. You understand why a man who goes with an adulterous wife is going to die? Proverbs makes that, 7 makes that very clear. This is an addendum note. It's because her husband is going to come home and deal with him. Nevertheless, the instructions of Shurupak do not place mothers on equal footing for instruction with fathers, nor do they highlight a female figure as the persona of wisdom. No virtuous woman or proverbs by a woman exists elsewhere, so far as I know, in ancient or Eastern literature. Nor does Shurupak exhort his son the way Proverbs does. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. She is a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts intoxicate you all the time. Always be drunk on her love. Unless you think that's demeaning to women, let me cast that in the context of the ancient Near East. Generally, throughout the ancient Near East, men owned their wives sexually. They didn't own them as property otherwise, but sexually they were owned by their husbands. So that the term Baal, which is a term for a deity, yes, but it's also the term, the legal term for husband, in the Hebrew Bible, refers to a male ownership over his wife's sexuality. So adultery was a sin against the other woman, the other woman's husband, not against her or against your wife. So your wife didn't count when it came to adultery. I hope that I made that clear. So sometimes I map this out on the board. You know, husband A and husband B. Adultery is between them, but wife A and wife B, it doesn't matter. It's not adultery against them. What is being suggested here is that it is adultery against your wife if you go to another woman. That's something you just don't find anywhere in the ancient Near East, even elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, so far as I know.
Is that because women didn't have choices? I mean, you know, would she be forced into a relationship if her husband's gone and somebody showed up?
No. If in defense of her husband, not. But not in defense of herself. And I think that's possibly true today in the Middle East, particularly in Muslim cultures. Now I'm coming to the questions to discuss, and my questions are long and complicated. Many of us grew up with the King James Version, where truly reading the Bible meant entering a man's world. You remember those days? Of course, women understood that man meant humankind, and that women were included in the men. I doubt, however, that they knew that those words in italics that were added words not found in the original languages, so that the word men in Proverbs became emphasized rather than marginalized. You understand? The Hebrew does not always have the word man, but the King James Version added it in there because the noun was masculine. And they wanted to and it was an adjective, so they needed a man in there to make it a masculine adjective. And the man was in italics, not because it was to be emphasized, but because it was an added word that the Hebrew didn't represent. Do you understand that? I think a lot of women didn't know that and assumed a man was emphasized rather than marginalized. In any case, women were assumed to be part of the man's world. So does it matter? Should we have inclusive language versions of the Bible like the New Revised Standard Version, today's New International Version, which I brought with me, and the Common English Bible? Does anything change for you, both genders, when you read a version like the New King James, which retains the man, or the English Standard Version, which is also very literally translated, and then read an inclusive language version? So that's question number one. Number two, why does Proverbs seem more open to the feminine voice rather than some other books of the Bible, such as the Psalms, containing hymns and prayers? Were there no women composers in ancient Israel? We could argue, and by the way, women composers did occur throughout the ancient Near East. We could argue, of course, that the Song of Songs may have been composed by a woman, but why aren't women's musical talents confined? Why are women's musical talents confined to the royal court love poetry and music and barred from standard worship? And by the way, how many hymns by women besides Fanny Crosby exist in our hymnal? And how many choral numbers have women in modern times, with apologies to John Rutter? Does it make a difference in our worship to still worship in a man's world? Number three, I have two twos. We can think of other areas of the Bible, such as Torah, where women are treated better in some laws than in comparative laws in the ancient Near East, and so were slaves, by the way. And there's an interesting shift that takes place in historical books with two women featured in Joshua, Rahab and Aksa. The latter forms part of the link between Joshua and Judges because the same pericope occurs in Judges 1. You have the same story twice. Exact same wording. Women loom larger but meet with tragic violence towards the end in the stories of Jephthah's daughter and Levi's concubine. I think we're hearing about Jephthah's daughter in a few minutes. A woman's story opens the book of 1 Samuel, but once a king rules over Israel, women become increasingly marginalized. What is the significance of this? Number four, this should be. What difference does all of this make in terms of our theology? What happens when women are marginalized? When they are treated with equal inclusion? Note the terminology. The way we use equality seems to be a power term and suggests equal in power. But true equality is an inclusive term meant to suggest that we are all in this together equally. In other words, did the theology of the Seventh-day Adventist Church suffer between 1930 and 1995 and beyond with the virtual abandonment of employment of women pastors? Before 1930, we had lots of women and pastors. In fact, the recent somebody did an analysis and they came up with a statistic of about one for, does anybody remember reading that? If you were on the I Support the Ordination of Women Facebook group, you would have seen it. But it suggests that the same number of women per, well, a larger number of women per so many Adventists were pastors compared to now. Yes?
I was listening to a sermon that Pastor Andy Roberts had done this weekend and invited a man to come speak about ordination. And this man said, and I could have the dates wrong, but it seems to me like ordination didn't start until like the 1800s. Is that right?
Well, Adventists voted to ordain women, I think, in 1881. But they never followed through with it.
Start, period. When did ordination start?
We never have ordained women.
No, I mean ordination in general.
Oh, ordination and of men. Oh, it started in, ordination of men started with the priesthood in, the 5th century?
But this wasn't something that really God had started.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, why do we even need to make an issue of ordination? Why don't we just set it aside and then we don't have this issue of who needs to be ordained and who's not and who's being left out and who's not. And shouldn't we all be tent makers and shouldn't we all be going out preaching the gospel?
the problem has more to do with, various theologians have suggested this, but they always back down from it, because the bottom line is, in our society at this time, you have to credential people. You have to find a way to validate that they are speaking for us.
And they should be held accountable, too.
What?
They should be held accountable, too.
Yeah.
They want professionals to
answer. So that's where it's a practical problem. Even among those theologians who agree it's not biblical to ordain. There's not a shred of biblical evidence for ordination. But anyway, let me finish my question here. During this period, men only preached most sermons from a male-centric viewpoint to congregations in which there were usually more women than men. Did it make a difference in terms of the weekly fare of pictures of God, of duties to be done, sins to be shunned, to use traditional terminology? And what can we learn from Proverbs' treatment of women that we can take home and apply? All right. The floor is yours. Yes?
I want to know the first of number two about worship. And just, like, again, because I don't know that much about Proverbs itself, but just kind of contrast with, like, contemporary worship. And I was thinking at first about, like, the worship music that I listen to, whether it's kind of more alternative, like Switchfoot, or more like authentic worship, like David Crowder or something like that, but it's almost entirely male-led, even if they do have women lead out certain songs. Then I was thinking about worship services, like, often there are women, like, either, like, doing the harmonies or whatever, like, but, or even leading out an individual song, but I can only think of one individual student here who has been, like, the band leader for Vespers as a woman. The rest have all been male students. And not that it necessarily is bad to have male students lead, but at the same time, like, that's almost the predominant factor. Like, and I admire, it's Ari Casiano is the only female student that I can think of, and, you know, she does great. But at the same time, there are no other women stepping up as worship leaders within PUC Church that I see.
Karen the new chooser?
Not independently.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
A generational thing, though. And I was in academy, maybe even college, I can't remember here, because in academy it was me, frankly. It was the girls who led out in the singing, in the music. We could be song leaders and sometimes scripture readers, and then that was about it. So,
and like what Professor Newman said is accurate. Like sometimes we do have, like, all the singers are female, but they're, except for Ari, as far as I'm aware, they're never the leader for the entire set. They're just the only one singing. So it'll be one of the musicians who's directing when to stop and when to go back to the chorus and things like that. So.
Question that came up in my mind in looking at that, you know, why there was no Song of Deborah in the Psalter. Is there any correlation between how much education women could have or not? Because if you're not taught to read or write,
but the men weren't either in those days. So that's a really moot question because there was little education, period.
So who wrote down all of these things then that are...
It would probably be in the court, the royal court, where there was trained people. The elite could write. It was an elitist thing. Jill.
I'm surprised in rereading in Proverbs 31, which I've always thought was just such a wonderful tribute to women. That this is, even though it was written by King Lendroll, he was quoting his mother.
Yes.
And I hadn't realized...
She wrote a portion of Proverbs.
...that was behind so much of this, which is really interesting from a perspective as to women authors. That...
Yeah, and keep in mind, you're dealing with a predominantly oral and aural society. And in an oral society... things get handed down, and women do have their say, but we don't see it. And it's the men who decided the canon of the Bible. Right?
Go back to this thing we're talking about changing, you know, in the 30s or so, and a swimmer for him, and power and control of the church. Seems to me it's a power and control issue. You know, when men begin to feel that they're losing a certain amount of control and power, they place, in fact, policies that will place them more in control. So in that case, there's less women active. And sad to say, many of the women, or not many, but women, the passive, will go along with the men. The more assertive, the more women who, what's the word? We call them liberals today, but you know, the ones who speak up.
Feminists.
Are put down. And they usually, you know, go back to the early times of the church and say, well, men were in control in the Far Eastern and Eastern and Asian countries, the Middle East. The man is still the patriarchal family, you know, the man's in control, the women have to adhere to what he has to say. I don't know, it seems to me that in many cases, power and control is an issue in most of our problems.
But that, and I want to address that actually in this third question. If you follow through canon, through women loom large but meet with tragic violence near the end of the story, you still have a woman's story opening the book of Samuel. But once a king rules over Israel, women become increasingly marginalized. And I did a study actually as part of my paper for Adventist Society for Religious Studies in 2012. In which I correlated, you can correlate it in ancient Near Eastern texts, particularly in Mesopotamia, that women become increasingly marginalized to the extent that you have male dominance and power. And so you have, in the early periods of the old Babylonian period and before, women play a much more prominent role in all levels of society. And then you come down to Neo-Assyria, and Neo-Babylonia, and the 8th, 7th, 6th centuries. Society completely changes because everything becomes conquest and power and subjugation, dominance and control. And women are correspondingly oppressed and marginalized. Women still have power to do things, but they don't use that power. Something holds them back. And so it's, you can just correlate it across the board. And so I think you've hit a nail on the head that when we exercise power, and when power becomes the prominent thing, various things happen. We end up with an elitist society. We end up with a lot of marginalized people in various ways.
Jason, would you say that? Isn't this possibly one of the main reasons why God said that Israel shouldn't have a king? Because
the
news was going to happen.
The Old Testament really, the Old Testament as a whole really opposes any kind of hierarchy. You can take Genesis particularly and demonstrate that throughout it.
On that, isn't there at least a minority voice in the Old Testament that there was no king in the land in those days, and every man did what was right in his own?
Oh yes, yes. That's where Judges ends.
I think there's an ambivalence. I just, in terms of power control, what we know about post-Civil War American religion is that the institutions now known as the liberal and mainline Protestant denominations formally organized, they were leaders in the creation of bureaucracy for the sake of getting missions done of various kinds. The evangelical conservative fundamentalists trailed behind, but we caught that wave of fundamentalist organizing, and that is the underlying broader historical story of that 1930s thing that you're talking about. As formal organization happened, men dominated. Women in informal ways of leadership and ministry, at least in the Methodist church that I know best, were forced to the margins. And what I would observe about post-1960s is that the big, centrally organized, one level after another model of bureaucracy has been slowly breaking down in terms of enterprise groups, decentralization, various ways of decentralizing modern business, and guess who's following in the train trying to adjust to that?
It's a great point.
Yeah, and which is why when I read about American history, we read about the monoliths of economy, the corporate world where there were these huge corporations that snuffed out all the little businesses. And I don't think in a previous era that we would have been aware of that, probably. Yeah.
It's interesting that Solomon was put on the throne by his mother.
She was a puppet, though.
I disagree. She is the one. She used puppets. She used general.
Oh, she. Oh. You're saying she used Nathan, not the other way around.
I absolutely. She is the one who called him.
Yeah.
She is the That's one right. who set up the plan to see to it that her son got onto the throne.
Yeah.
Very powerful woman.
Yeah. Certain women who can manipulate behind the scenes rise to power. But that power is never their own.
They exercise that power through men.
Through men, right. But it still marginalizes all other women.
I don't disagree.
Well, even when women have been the head, trust me, they've been turning the neck. For a long time. She's the head sometimes, and she's always the neck that's turning the head, I can tell you that. But one thing that's interesting, you know, I see it even in our own church when Bernice and I lived in Syracuse, they're in the Northeastern Conference. I mean, they still want the King James Versions, you know, preached from, and even in Sabbath school with my early teens, I was going to say, they want to use King James Version. And I remember one time at church, you know, I used he or she and they instead of he. And afterwards, like, Sister Howland says to me, "Honey, my King James Bible doesn't say that. It says he, you know." and so, you know, so there's still some of that even here. And like, I mean, in that church, they didn't want any female elders, local elders, let alone pastors.
This is actually a resurgence that we're seeing right in the church. This is not just the leftovers of. This is actually a deliberate and rather forceful comeback, saying we don't want this other stuff anymore. We want it this way, and of course the King James. That's a whole different can of worms.
But you know
the King James version
is some of it is being led by women, not
well, that's true.
Well, not just men. Of course. Let me tell you what Kendra Holowiak noted, and this came out of a discussion we had a year ago when Kendra came here, and I believe she presented here, and then she presented in the afternoon. And in her afternoon meeting, she made this, I raised a question, which she responded, I asked her how it was with the women who were on task and supporting the anti-women's ordination faction. She made the comment that one of the women, who I'm pretty sure I know who this woman is, but I won't tell you. One of the women came to her, and the way she worded her question and the way she talked, Kendra picked up a note of utter despair that if I'm wrong, then all I've put up with all these years of my marriage is... So that, to me, is one of the reasons I think that women play these roles. They have to.
I mean, you know, the thing is amazing. It's not just a fairness issue, although that's an inequity. That's a big thing. It's about effectiveness. And, like, we're leaving half or more than half of the people that have talents and abilities
women,
go out of the picture.
Women are 60% of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And there's been, I think about 10 years ago, they were 70% of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And I'm going to come back to that point.
I'm going to pass. That's too long.
I would like to move to the next to the last question and address this briefly as we close. I think it makes a huge difference in our theology. I really, really do. I really believe that there would never have been an Inquisition and Protestants fighting the stepchildren of the Reformation, the radical reformers, and all of the holy wars that, I mean that in proverbial language, not literal, that we've had through the centuries if women had equal say in the theology of the Christian faith. And I would also like to point out to you something I pointed out at when I received my ordination credentials 2 years ago. And that is that when God created humankind in his image, created the male and female, and he gave them both dominion over the natural world. When he did that, gender is determined by chromosomes. Created 3/4 female and 1/4 male. And if that's the case, the image of God is far more weighted in nurture, in protection, in love, and tender care than it is in might and power. Pray. Father, we ask that as we continue this journey that our church is on, that these truths may stand up and show themselves clearly and be as a beacon to the world church. We know that you can work in ways that we can't. And so we ask that your voice, your preferred voice, may be heard. On this issue, may we not make that impossible by anything that we do or say. We pray in Jesus' name.